we covered some of the geopolitical things that were going on about this time during the so-called Middle Ages, which 500, 1500 nominally, and how during the period of time there were the Germanic tribes were predominant in Europe and were invading Italy, and then we eventually started invading, making raids on Rome. And finally, after a period of time, the what we knew, know as the Roman Empire, disappeared, fell in 476 A.D. And a different emperor took over, a German guy, Odoacer, I guess. I love these names. At the same time, or parallel to that, or right after that, 100 years or so, we had Gregory come on the scene, Gregory I, Gregory the Great. And he was the Bishop of Rome in 590. Got himself involved by history. He was actually was appointed as a in a political office, and then he converted over to, or became a monk. But he had it in his blood, I guess you'd say, to be involved in secular activities. And so he really desired to have temporal power. That's one of the things that was on his mind, and he, in effect, got it. He was active while he was pope, really pre-pope, first pope being Pope Boniface that would follow him. He was involved, though, in conversions of these tribes that came into Italy and into Europe, and sent missionaries out. It's very active in that. And typically, it would come by way of conversion of a leader, and then once he got the leader converted, others would, of the tribe would be converted. As a bit of trivia, Gregory, if you look in the songbook, you'll see these chants, Gregorian chants. He actually was active in writing music. And those chants that you see are written by Gregory in his time. At least I know, don't remember what the song is, but I know there's one that caught my eye one time. Yeah, that's his.
What was that? What
did he say? He started the Gregorian chant. Yeah, he wrote it. And he involved himself in the liturgy and that kind of thing of the church at the time. It brings us up to where we were talking about doctrines that developed under him, and there are two of them primarily. One's penance and the other one's purgatory. We talked a bit about penance, which would come to mean to do penance, which really meant to provide some sort of satisfaction for the crime or the sin you committed. And of course, the sin could be forgiven if you did that. And it worked up on the heels of this, and this was in 590 to 604, on the heels of that would come the development of a formalized system of indulgences, which would ultimately lead to, or at least would be a big part of what would bring on the Reformation in Germany. One of the things I wanted to go back and just comment on that has come up in class, and it doesn't figure into particularly this specific doctrine, but it's one that, it's a teaching that had come along in the same time frame, and that is limbo. And the reason I wanted to bring it up is because we had a discussion of it in here, and whether or not it was in limbo, if limbo was in limbo or if it was still active. And the interesting thing about that, and this is typical of what we've seen in some of these studies relative to councils, there was actually a group, a commission of the Vatican, called the International Theological Commission. And they studied this for a number of years, and they finally came out with a report in April of this year. And their conclusion was, and this is where unbaptized, what they were really focusing on were the unbaptized infants that would be in limbo. And what they were saying is, it seemed to reflect an unduly restrictive view of salvation to have unbaptized infants spend eternity without communion with God. And they said baptism is the normal way to salvation, but they urged parents to have their infants baptized, but they recognized that God's merciful mercy trumps over sin, and exclusion of innocent babies just didn't make any sense in view of the way Jesus felt about children. This is their comments. Now remember, these babies are innocent, but they're not innocent. What put them in purgatory to begin with? I mean, in limbo to begin with? They're unbaptized, and they're not saved by Catholic doctrine. One of the reasons they did this, had to study, is because there was just so many unbaptized babies in the world dying. And we'll see when we talk through this period of time that extraordinary measures were taken to try to get babies baptized, even when they were going to die within minutes or hours of being born. And they didn't see that being what God would do. He would not put them in limbo. And the thing I just want to kind of underline for you, while limbo has just been regarded as a teaching of the church, it has not been in their so-called catechism. It's not a doctrine of the same caliber as baptism and things of that nature, but it's clearly been taught for years and years. And what this group concluded is, our conclusion is that the many factors that we have considered give serious theological and liturgical, thank you, grounds for hope that unbaptized infants who die will be saved and enjoy the beatific vision, that is basically the blessings of heaven eventually. He says, we emphasize that these are reasons for prayerful hope rather than grounds for sure knowledge. So even though they conclude limbo is no longer, you can't really be sure. We're just giving you hope. But there's no basis. Of course, there's no basis for limbo in the first place. I just thought that was an interesting conclusion they reached. You have grounds for hope, but we do not have sure knowledge about it. Okay? So, back to these two doctrines in hand, and they went hand in hand, actually. You had penance as being what would become a sacrament, and purgatory is not a sacrament, it's a doctrine. And they linked that they would actually could use purgatory as a means of, if you like, threat, that if you did not have your sins forgiven, you did not do penance, then you may find yourself in purgatory, depending on the nature of the sin. Other sins, you may find yourself worse off than purgatory. So they viewed purgatory as a way, really, as a mechanism of providing incentive, if you like, for people who committed sin and needed to do penance. So that got pretty well involved in the church from Gregory's time on. And really, Gregory had a big impact. And you find you find pivotal people in the development of the Catholic Church. This is true. And he had a big impact as far as the Western Church in this period of time, setting doctrine, setting organization, and the like. And so the direction was being set by him. Purgatory, by the way, they make just a comment. Purgatory, they shall suffer punishment for mortal sins whose guilt has been forgiven, but whose debt of punishment has not yet been remitted. And therein lies the threat. I may forgive your sin as the priest, but you have to do penance, and if you don't, you're going to purgatory. Okay? You have to spend some period of time there until you can get out, I guess. The other thing about it is, once in purgatory, the Catholic doctrine was to provide a means to pray people, pray them out of purgatory, basically, or to do penance that would get them moved out of dead people moved out of purgatory. They'd rather have the latter rather than the prayers. That's right. And so it was built in, and of course it was corrupt to the core, and became, if you can become more corrupt, it did as time went on.
That was the
indulgence kept you. They eventually made it to the point where you had to have indulgences to be forgiven. But even if you're forgiven, you had to have indulgences, or you find yourself in purgatory early on. Say indulgences, that's what it would become called.
When you pray for somebody in purgatory, don't you have to pay something? Wasn't this a way for the
Catholic Church? That's the way it developed. It eventually evolves into that, where you're...
I know to light a candle for somebody to pay, that may be just a memory of somebody I'm not positive, but I was thinking of some payment.
Now, clearly in the middle, as you approach the time of the... I don't remember right now when this occurs, but as it evolves, but when you approach the Reformation time, this is one of the aspects that not the dead, but the requirement for indulgences, which would include just what you're talking about, isn't simply praying for. Yes, he was big on the badness of indulgence, well, the corruptness of it,
right.
And so. His theses went up on the board as a result. Okay, let's talk about the rise of the Holy Roman Empire. And what we're going to see over the next few pieces is how the popes are competing, basically, with the emperors, whoever they might be, for power. And that's fundamentally what it's all about. Of course, go back to Constantine and he favored Christianity, and it wasn't until Theodosius in 392 actually made Christianity the state religion. And so he did that, said any heathen sacrifices were heresy and punishment for death. As we mentioned last lesson, we had all these tribes that had over time been coming in. In the period of time between then and when we start talking about primarily the 750 time frame, you had Visigoths who controlled Spain, southern France, Ostrogoths who controlled Italy up to 544 anyway, Burgundians who controlled southeastern France, Vandals, North Africa, and the Lombards. Northern Italy up to 774, and the Lombards become one of the tribes that are used as a way of enhancing, increasing the power of, depending on which way you're looking at it, either the emperor or the pope at the time. We'll cover that in a moment. All these tribes accepted some form of Christianity. Remember, we talked last time, it was Arian, was what they were taught. So it was an Arian church. And in fact, for a period of time, there were basically two wings going on in Europe, one Arian and one Catholic. And they were in conflict a lot of the time. And not only were they in conflict, but they, in being in conflict, there was a question of pride, I suppose, and it wasn't theology almost as much as it was pride. And the Franks, as part of this, who were Arian, over time, eventually took on the Roman view, the Catholic view. And in doing so, they became more powerful. They had an ally, and of course Rome had an ally in them as well. And they ended up starting to bring other tribes under their influence and accept the Roman ideas as well. One of the things about this period, about the invaders, is they were illiterate. And they get the name barbarian for good reason, because of the way they behaved, but they didn't value education, and nor did they worry about culture. I mean, they went in and just destroyed. And so as a result of that, the way they were versus the way the general Rome, the Catholic Church at this time, and the people they were conquering, who were cultured, who had a history of education to some degree, they felt themselves inferior. And that created some problems as well. But in the course of their taking over, these barbarians just destroyed learning in many fronts. And this is one of the forces that had the monasteries, where you could have learned people, you know, religious people, maintain some degree of education. And in fact, that's where most of if you look at the things we get now in the way of the writings of the time, they tend to come out, the religious writings of the time, they tend to come out of the monasteries. That's where they had some protection and where there was learning was kept alive. As you might imagine, it reminds me a little bit in our day and age of a period of time we're in Iraq and you've got all this turmoil and chaos. In some ways, some people look back to the time of Saddam Hussein and say, well, at least things were stable. And that is a little bit the way this is, chaos, and people were looking something, they were looking to go back at some kind of rule and authority. And so the Roman Church found an opportunity to have a stabilizing influence. So they were able to start exercising, the bishop was, to start exercising power that way as well. So we get into a papacy that is becoming more and more integrated with the secular governments, and I've got it in your notes there. In 754, you had Pope Stephen going to France. I mentioned the Lombards a while ago. They had largely controlled northern Italy, and he went to France and he anointed Pippin the Short as king of Franks. And Pippin came down then and drove the Lombards out of Italy and gave the Pope these papal states. And the papal states, if you kind of think of it as in the boot, you think of it as the area around Rome, and it goes up and heads up a little bit north. It's about 30, probably was 30% of Italy at the time. So the Pope is now in control of his own little nation within the nation, so to speak. Pepin died. When he died, his kingdom was divided between his son, Charlemagne, name we know, probably heard, and his brother, Carloman. Carloman died, and Charlemagne took control of the entire empire. And in an attempt to strengthen his rights to it over the children of Carloman, he enlisted the Pope to be on his side. And there was another invasion comes along, again to drive the Lombards further out of Italy, I suppose. And Charlemagne went down to Rome, and in the course of that time, he was actually coronated as king or emperor by the Pope. And so the Pope did him a favor, and in this case it was Pope Leo III, and in doing so, Charlemagne increased his territory, gave him more land. But at this time, you've got these two bodies, two positions, if you like, and they're, you know, enemy of your enemy the enemy of your enemy is my enemy, I guess is the way it is, or the friend of your enemy, however that goes, that's kind of the way they were. It was, the emperor wanted all the power, the pope wanted all the power, but neither of them were going to win that battle in the near term. And so they were, while they vied for it, it was yet to be worked out. And in fact, the emperors, because of the impact the Pope could have on a broad number of people, they tried to favor the church and the, and the strengthen the papacy, because they could have a point of control, basically. And during this time, although the Pope was not getting more involved in the actual running of the government was getting more involved in running of the church. And so you've got Charlemagne in particular at this time ended up being very much of a hands-on person, active in the leadership of the church, right, and there with the Pope. And he directed missions, he sponsored legislation, he strengthened the government of the church, he supervised the election of bishops, established schools, monasteries, and that kind of thing. He did have a falling out with the Pope over image worship. And remember, we talked about that in the Second Council of Nicaea. That was still an issue even at this point in time, 20, 30 years later. But by his influence, image worship stayed out of the area north of the Alps until probably the 11th century. He organized his empire into metropolitans, 21 of them, and in each one of those he set up an archbishop. And the archbishops had bishops under them. And so he arranged for that. And so he's having an impact on running the church, the Catholic Church at this stage. With his death, there were three grandsons came into the play, but finally in 962, Otto the Great reunified the emperor and was crowned emperor of the empire and was crowned emperor. And this, there are two views about when did the Holy Roman Empire start. This is one with Otto, mainly because it was an unbroken chain of succession. Charlemagne actually had a Roman Empire as well that was integral with the church, but because of the subsequent emperors, that lineage, generally not by history, even though I said it was, I think in your notes I said he was was at the beginning of the Holy Roman Empire. You can look at that either way. There were three, by this time there's three views about the emperor and the pope. They've each got their spheres of influence. That's one view. Second view is the emperor is over the pope and over those matters. And of course the third view is the temporal was subordinate to the pope, to the spiritual. And this is in around 1,000 or so, 900, 950,000, that period of time. And as you know by your own history, where the whole of Europe was moving was into feudal system. And so you had these lands that would be given out and held in trust or by a vassal to a lord. That lord would end up being a vassal to a king of some sort, and the kings were vassals to the emperor. And so you've got the emperor in control of all of this, and he claimed the emperor was the vassal of God. Well, that didn't set well with the pope, as you might imagine, because he viewed himself as a vassal of God on earth. And so that battle continued to go on for some time. Otto the Great, in spite of this situation, Otto the Great, and there's a little bit, I guess I ought to make this clear, there's a little bit of the politics of archbishops, bishops, and the emperor over here, and Rome, the pope, and trying to have some control over here. So the emperor is sort of running the show, and the pope is wanting to have these bishops and archbishops to be his people and where he appoints them. But in fact, what was happening is the emperor was granting so-called investiture, which is appointing of these church officials. And the pope himself ends up being God's emperor is acting as God's representative on earth instead of the pope. And throughout this period, this power of investiture appointment reigned with the emperor. And the emperors then got to the point where they were appointing the pope as well. So this Holy Roman Empire, the pope didn't come about like you and I are accustomed to the pope coming about in this day and age. They were appointed by the emperors. Henry III in 1046, there were three rival popes, and he disposed of all of them and appointed a German bishop head of the church. And then there were some of the empires after him, emperors after him, appointed, I think there were three more popes after that got appointed that way. So there was no doubt at this point in time that emperors over the church, that's who's running the show. And so that's not setting well with the pope, and he wants to bring about change, which leads us into this fraudulent document, the false decretals of Isidore. Anything about any of that, that's a thousand years as fast as I know how to speak it.
I thought slowly but surely the church was gaining kind of supremacy because they would anoint
Emperors.
And so the emperors looked like they were in cahoots, or they made ties together to strengthen each other almost.
What would happen? See, what's happening is in some cases you had later on you're actually going to have popes that would. There were popes that appointed in 12. You got to get out. I think it's like 1300s or so. You would have popes that started to take. They started to gain power, and we'll see that in a second. They started to gain more power and influence, and you would come to the point where they would actually, the popes would actually appoint the kings or dispose of them. I mean, that was one of the things that was tried with King Henry VIII, is it? Ended up with the Church of England because he divorced. And that was the kind of power they had at the time, and he basically said, not in my backyard. I'll show you. So yeah, they were not at this stage. They were while they've been trying for some time to end up being total king of the mountain. This idea that it's the city of God, the spiritual trumps temporal. They were still working on that. They hadn't achieved that quite yet. And really, what comes first, chicken or egg? It leads to most likely in this time frame these false decretals. And this fellow Isidore was a legitimate person at the time. He was a Spanish archbishop, and he actually did do a lot of writing to try to enhance or contribute to the centralization of the ecclesiastic authority in Rome. And because he did have influence, somebody came with the right idea, evidently, that they could forge some works and claim they came from him, and that would add a lot of weight to whatever was in the work. And that's what this decretal ended up being. It was a forged document, and after he was dead, obviously, they pretended that they had found it, something he had written that nobody knew about. And they started using that, they being the Pope, started using that as a means to start to get his power extended. The contents of this, it's not all that important what the contents were per se, other than they dealt with a couple of things, and one was the power of the Bishop of Rome over all ecclesiastical matters of the church. And these look back to things were written in synods that didn't exist, or at least the documents didn't exist, or apostolic fathers. I mean, there's all kinds of sources that were in this document. Of course, they were all fake, all forgery. And the second part of it was that not only was Rome over all of the church, but the spiritual was to be over the temporal. And a fellow named Nicholas was one that, this was shortly after they came out, he made the first use of them to try to increase his authority in and over the church and any place else he could as well. And so he starts to draw the bishops, starts working on drawing the bishops and the archbishops back under his wing. And in fact, he made some progress in the latter part of his reign, and not only claimed supremacy, but deposed of some of the archbishops, forced the king to end up taking back his divorced queen and things of that nature. So he actually had some achievements, if you please, based on these decretals, to give himself more power and to give the papacy more power. There was a part of this decretal called the donation. This was integral into it. It was called the donation of Constantine. So it goes all the way back to Constantine. And Constantine supposedly had leprosy, and Peter and Paul appeared to him in a vision and baptized him three times and cleansed him of leprosy. So he exalted Sylvester, who was the Pope at the time, or the Bishop of Rome. And he makes this comment. It's the first time I read this statement about this position, so I wanted to share it with you, since he, talking about Sylvester, is seen to have been set up as the vicar of God's Son. So we'll see this term, vicar of God's Son, which of course is the way Pope looks at the position the Pope is looked at. The pontiff, and I won't read the rest of it, but he calls for the veneration of the Roman Church and the Pope, the Bishop of Rome. And so the papacy used these documents as being real documents to make their case. And they made a pretty effective case. They influenced them. Remember, people are not educated at this time. So you can pull off things like this without being challenged too much. It wouldn't be until the 15th century that there was any question raised about these, and as far as authenticity is concerned. But by then, the impact of them had been made, and the Pope had, over time, had taken a step into one of more power. His power was going up, his influence was going up, while the influence of the emperor was coming down. And I think that's pretty well the summation of the points around the increase of the papacy during this time period. Any questions about that? Comments? Okay, go back and visit. We're going to visit something we've touched on in the past, and that is this aesthetic lifestyle. And we've talked about in the Gnostics, we've talked in past classes, we don't need to rehash that. The whole origin of this monasticism came out of the ascetic background. And Jews, Greeks, both. Essenes, I know y'all have heard the name. These are the ones that were sort of peaked around 200 B.C. to 100 A.D. maybe, Cynics 400 B.C. So it predates the first century by quite a bit. And the same thing we've talked about in the past about evil, spirit being good, evil being bad, is what drove this whole thing. And as Constantine came on and you no longer had the persecution you had in the past, something had to take, in the minds of the people, something had to take the place of achieving the purity required for salvation. Martyrdom was no longer there, so along comes the asceticism move. There were actually two types that developed, one in the East, which was the hermit type. It's in the East area, in Egypt, and other areas, Syria, there are a lot of caves, and these hermit guys would actually go in and occupy a cave. Their way of handling this was to isolate themselves from the world, and live in a cave. There was a fellow named Anthony I mentioned there. Ended up being a leader of those who lived in caves around him. He really never organized them beyond that. In the 4th century, there was the Hermits Distarch to form groups. And they ended up, there's a fellow named, it really doesn't matter what his name is, one of these fellows ended up organizing the Hermits around him. They went out on an island that was in the Nile and set up a monastery. And so you have the first monastery in that area set up by these folks. He organized groups pretty soon. There were several thousand that were involved. There were monks under his supervision. And he had worked out a system, if you please, for them, for prayer, study, work, things of that nature that would become, that is a pattern, the same kind of pattern you've heard about in the monasteries. Most of these ascetics in this area were reasonable in their activities, but there were fanatics, real fanatics. They exposed themselves, didn't have the clothing. They'd go out in the winter and wouldn't have fire or clothes. There's some of them that would do nothing but eat grass, tried to play the part of Nebuchadnezzar, I guess, and they grazed like a head of cattle. And their objective was to destroy themselves through suffering. The world is, the world is evil. Matter is evil. So we're going to elevate ourselves by tormenting ourselves for the sake of Christ, even to the point of killing themselves. And this went on, whether it was animals or snakes or whatever. They had one guy I've always found this one kind of humorous. They had people that were called pillar saints, and they climb up on pillars. And that's how they got away from the world. Got one guy lived on a pillar 60 feet in the air for 36 years. And, I don't know. I guess he came down once in a while, or somebody gave him something.
Often wonder how they support themselves. They grow gardens or supply their own.
Well, the monks do. The monasteries, they do.
Monasteries, that's what I was talking about.
I assume they gather stuff from nature around them. And maybe some of their followers brought them things. I really don't know. This guy set on his. Evidently, he had a reputation. He was known far and wide. He actually sat up there and would make judgments, would preach from 60 feet up in the air. So. Strange. Shows you how far people will sometimes go when they get away from the Word of God. In the West, it was kind of a different path. And the one we kind of associate with monasteries and monks. The weather was colder to start off with, so not too many people wanted to be in a cave or sit up on a post. And it ended up that while there was ascetic tendencies in the West, they ended up taking a different path, a path that was more of an activist type of life. Benedict, the Benedictine monks, or order, was an organizer, the first organizer, and he withdrew from society, and he actually lived in a cave for about 3 years, and because of his piety, he drew his disciples around him, and he organized the disciples, the 12 of them, and himself, as to represent Christ, him, I suppose, and the other 12 was the apostles. He would build a monastery in 529. You may have heard this if you ever heard of if you've been to Italy, Monte Cassino. Monte Cassino is also the site of a World War II battle. If you watch History Channel once in a while, you'll see that. And his sister actually started a convent. What he had to teach was not new: poverty, chastity, and obedience. The monasteries were self-supporting. They set aside a certain schedule. You worked so many hours. You had 4 hours for prayer and worship, 8 hours for sleep, and the rest to write and study. So they raised their own food, etc. By about the middle of the 6th century, there were probably 100 monasteries in Europe after the pattern of the one he started. And it was viewed at that point, the monasteries were ready to take anybody that wanted a sure way to heaven. This was your sure way to heaven. as a result of that, a lot of those who were pious, the most devout, probably the most learned of the church at the time, ended up going into the monasteries. And so it depleted the leadership outside of the monasteries. And, you know, whether that would have made any difference in the path they had taken, I have no idea if they just stayed, you know, in and among the people. Of course, they were very active during the so-called Dark Ages, this period of time during the Middle Ages when people were illiterate. Well, they had literacy inside of the monasteries and preserved the manuscripts. You and I, a lot of the manuscripts we have today come out of monasteries. I mean, the manuscripts we have today that provide a textual basis for the Bible is preserved through the monasteries. So from that standpoint, you know, it kind of reminds you of how God would use nations, be they ever so evil, but they would achieve his objective. In any event, there was a conflict between this school and the church. And, you know, in part because you have them saying, look, the world's bad, and we need to get ourselves out of the world. Spirit's good, but we need to be out of the world. And the church wanting to say it's the city of God. We are the city of God, and we're going to rule the world, in effect. And from a spiritual perspective, and we'll make that happen in the temporal as well. And the thing that held them together was the sacraments. And this is one of those places where purgatory sort of, you know, because you had double standards. You had the monks wanting to live a pure life. You had everybody else. And there's a conflict there, double standard, and the way they work themselves through that is through purgatory. You either suffer here, or you can live like you want to, but have your sins forgiven by the priest and suffer in purgatory if you don't do what you need to do.
How did the sacraments become an equalizer? Were the monks only allowed to administer them?
Priest, any priest
okay, well,
was.
How did that equalize the monks and the people?
They had to have the sacraments. The church the sacraments only meant something from the church, so they had to have a sacrament. Monks are not priests. They're monks. They're not part of the hierarchy of the church. And the church hierarchy would offer the sacraments. So the monks, even though they saw all this evil out of the church, out of the people in the church and the leadership, they had to have the sacraments administered to them by the church. Okay? So that's how they kept it going. All right, we'll pick up, we'll finish up on that and get into, I think we should finish that lesson Sunday, Lord willing, and perhaps get into 11.
Were the monks supported by the indulgences that they received from the church?
No, they were supported by their own work.
They made wine.
Well, they did.
They did.
Yeah, as a matter of fact.
Mount Cassino, she's talking about.